You're listening to DraftKings Network.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Big Suey, presented by DraftKings.
Why are you listening to this show?
The podcast that seems very similar to the other Dan Le Batard podcast.
I'm sorry, I'm not going to apologize for that.
In fact, the only difference seems to be this imaging.
I have been tempted in restaurants just walking past tables to grab somebody's fries that if they're just there. That hasn't happened to you guys?
I've done it.
And now, here's the marching man to nowhere, Fat Face, and the habitual liar.
I was curious last week when I saw a headline cross my newsfeed. Facebook knows Instagram is toxic for teen girls, company documents show. The article was from the Wall Street Journal, which had in its possession leaked company materials, detailing how Facebook has known for years about the harmful effects of Instagram on teenage girls. Even as the company has said publicly, like during testimony in front of Congress, that Facebook had no reason to believe any such thing. Facebook, of course, owns Instagram, buying it for a cool $1 billion in 2012. One of the leaked internal slides read, "Teens blame Instagram for increases in rate of anxiety and depression." Meanwhile, publicly, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg has always maintained his position that the research shows that social apps connect people, reaping positive mental health benefits. Although the data often focuses on the effects on teenage girls, it's worth noting that Instagram doesn't do a whole lot for the mental health of teenage boys either. And I've often wondered if possibly one reason for the steeper effect on girls is simply their increased willingness to acknowledge their feelings. Okay, if we're willing to accept the proposition that Instagram does, in fact, increase anxiety and depression among teenagers, as the data shows, then we must also acknowledge that many of our most popular athletes grew up in the social media age, grew up being affected by these same forces. So as this article was being absorbed and aggregated and dissected over the last few days, my mind repeatedly turned toward the sports world. Over the last few years, and specifically the last couple months, athletes have begun speaking out about the various ways they're affected by, among other things, anxiety, depression, panic attacks, mood disorders, and the relentless pressure of the media machine. The two most recent examples, gymnast Simone Biles stepped back from participating in most of the Tokyo Olympics for mental health reasons, and before that, tennis star Naomi Osaka, she decided against playing in the French Open after questioning the soundness of the press conference format. As she wrote in Time magazine, "Perhaps we should give athletes the right to take a mental health break from media scrutiny on the rare occasion without being subject to strict sanctions." It's worth noting the correlation, although perhaps not causation, between the social media age and the beginning of what seems like a new era of openness from our athletes about their mental health, and all the forms it can take, from general anxiety to depression that needs to be medicated with prescriptions. This is not a simple conversation. Sports are built on many principles, but the one I'm thinking of now is discomfort. The only way to get faster is to push your body to the brink. The only way to get stronger is to tear down your muscles. Sports is about pushing outside your comfort zone until you make it your comfort zone, then doing that over and over and over again. And yet, something is shifting. And for the better, I think. Better to know exactly why Simone Biles isn't competing, rather than passively believing it's a pulled hamstring or tweaked ankle, which is what we've always been told when an athlete needs a break, for one reason or another. We must acknowledge that the water in which this next generation of athletes have grown up is very different from that in which any previous generation has grown up, as evidenced by that Wall Street Journal article about that leaked Instagram data. The world is different now. It's changing all of us in subtle ways. We're carrying more of everything: information, knowledge, comparison, expectations. But what does it mean for sports? We now welcome in Meadowlark's Brain Trust. We got Tom Haberstroh, Amin El-Hassan, and Howard Bryant here. That was my voice essay on this topic. I'm Kate Fagan. And the four of us wanted to jump in and talk about what has been happening over the last couple of years, and specifically in the last couple of months in the sports world, about how we talk about mental health and how athletes speak openly and what effects that might have on sports. Howard, let's start with you here. How do you think this impacts sports?
Well, I think it has an enormous effect on sports, considering so much of sports is based on not just forehands and backhands and touchdowns and jump shots, but the umbrella question of adversity, coming through adversity, fighting through adversity, all of the different tropes. It covers so much ground. And the ground that you're really talking about is, how are you holding up? What is a sport doing to you? We treat this piece of it as though it is absolutely the number one sign of weakness, if you even admit that any of it's getting to you, nerves and pressure and the rest of it. There are so many examples of it. So the fact that this is on the table in 2021 is really going to change how we talk about every single piece of this landscape, how we talk about the game, how we talk about dealing with the game, media, all of it.
Yeah, when I was at BR Magazine, I wrote a magazine feature about this topic. Is the NBA is the most social media crazy league, obsessed league on Twitter, on Instagram, TikTok. And yet you had, I think, a tacit admission that it's bad for you. You had LeBron James saying during the playoffs, like, I'm going zero dark 30. I'm not going on social media. Other players saying the same thing, which is essentially, I know social media is toxic, but I can't quit that habit. And for that feature, in 2018, mind you, J.J. Redick had just retired, not from the NBA like he did, but he had retired from going on social media, period. He deleted his Instagram account. He deleted his Twitter because he realized that a lot of the elements of social media is addictive, and he really felt like it was a problem. It was a dark place, and he got himself off of it. He removed it altogether. But fast forward to 2021, he announces his retirement from the NBA, and he posts on Twitter, and last I checked, the video he posted got 2 million views. So he's already back on social media for his media career. But I think a lot of the lessons he learned is that, man, at 34 years old, do I need to be on social media? Like, this seems like a young person's game, is being on social media. And yet as he transfers out of the NBA, moves into his next career, his next phase, he's back on social media. It's a hard thing to kick, even for a veteran like J.J. Redick.
The question that I have about social media and as it relates to athlete mental health is this question of pressure. Because what has been implied both by the Facebook data and our general discussion around social media is that there's more pressure on young people than ever. And of course that young people includes athletes. And now we're seeing them saying that it seems as if sports has created a level of pressure on them that they actually at times need to step away from. Is that fair, Amin?
Yeah, I think the thing that I try to remind myself a lot is the generational divide and when it occurs, right? Because it's easy to say, I'm old or these kids or whatever. But to really understand what the generational gap is, it's literally, did you grow up with this or was this something that happened to you as an adult? Meaning, I remember when Instagram became a thing, when it was iPhones only. Nobody on the Android could download Instagram. I was a grown man at that point. You know, I think I might have already had my first child, maybe even. Twitter, same thing. 2008, 2009, I was damn near 30. So it was always just kind of an accoutrement to life. It has its values, you can share information, you find like-minded people, you crack jokes about the same sorts of stupid things that happen. We're watching the Oscars, ha ha, what is he wearing? And then the generational gap happens with the people who grew up with it, meaning, you know how it says you have to be 13 or older, to start, like they were like waiting on with bated breath. When will I turn 13 so I can legally get this if I hadn't already done and lied about my age? And so much of their conception of what is good, how do we value things, how I look, how I sound, what my ideas are, what I'm watching, it's all validated through this. It's not through peer groups. It's not at school. It's through this app. So now I'm coming to grips with those children are not children. They're in their mid-20s. They're competing in sports. And their very psychology has been twisted in a way that athletes competing against them in the same era, who are maybe 2 or 3 or 4 years older, do not have that same twisted psychology.
Yeah, I mean, you start looking at historically, every generation has its medium. Every generation has its the way that it communicates. And the biggest difference, obviously, is the one-way communication versus the two-way communication, the anonymity versus the familiar. And there is an addicting culture to it. There's an addictive quality to it because people need validation. So how many times do you check and how many likes you get on a given post? It's almost as if people, I've gotten to the point where I just feel people need to be heard. They don't feel like they're being heard. There's a flip side, however, to being heard, and that is being attacked. And that is also the way that this generation communicates with the world. I mean, you look at people and people now communicate primarily through tech. People don't even really talk to each other that much anymore. So you've got this flow of information, of people coming towards you. I'm fascinated by the amount of intimacy that people have with people they've never met. They don't even know if it's a real person, but yet the volume of it is so overwhelming, and especially for a professional athlete. There's always been a battle in terms of protecting yourself from us, from the newspaper people. I don't read the paper. Yeah, you do. You read the paper. And if you don't read the paper, one of your boys or one of your friends or your mom read the article about you, or your girlfriend is reading the, or your boyfriend is reading the stories and telling you, here's what it's all about, right? Here's what this person said about you. So there's always been that. The difference here is the volume. It's just the massive amount of volume.
Howard, I was wondering if what you thought about this analogy. Earlier today, I listened to a podcast of the head of Instagram on the Recode podcast talking about his response or Instagram's opinion of that Wall Street Journal piece. And he said something interesting. He said, to me, social media is like a car. We would all agree that cars lead to more mortalities or fatalities in car accidents. And that's not good. There are bad outcomes with cars. But we're ignoring all the positive outcomes of cars is transportation and the mobility of cars and all the good that comes with cars. And I don't agree with that analogy, because while cars do have a positive use and utility in America and worldwide, it's also heavily regulated.
Yeah.
And yeah,
he's also making the, I think, assumption in using that argument that we would all agree that social media is a net positive, because we would all agree that cars are a net positive despite the risks we take in using them. I would question his assumption that social media is a net good. If we cut to the heart of this question, which is that over the last 2 years, going back to Kevin Love publicly discussing panic attacks he had in the NBA through DeMar DeRozan, Michael Phelps, now to Naomi Osaka and Simone Biles, do we think that athletes saying that they are taking time off for mental health, or that it, whether they say the word pressure or whether they're implying that the pressure of life and all that comes with it is the reason that they either need time off or can't perform, do we think that is good for sports?
Yeah, I think, Kate, the real question here on top of that is the issues with the term mental health is that it covers so much ground. It's so broad. You have to narrow it down. What are we actually talking about? There's all kinds of different degrees and levels and spectrum of mental health. Clinical depression and dealing with pressure may not be the same thing. They may be, they may not be. I think the question really is, will this sports culture accept it? Will the sports culture allow for this to be real and acceptable, or are we going to be too willing to cling to the old narratives that we've had that this is part of the battle? This is part of the mountain that you're climbing to be a champion. This is what it takes to be a champion. And if you need to take time off, then you're not really a champion.
Howard, without saying, well, you don't have what it takes, but isn't that part and parcel of the journey? Part and parcel of what we value about the champions is their ability to block out the noise and the real stresses and pains. If you think about Brett Favre, is best game ever. Most people would say, I guess, 96 Super Bowl. His second best game ever, everyone's going to say Monday Night Football when his father died. I'm not saying that everyone's got to go out there and perform when they've lost something like that. Everyone grieves differently. But yeah, we do value that. Yeah, there is something otherworldly and superhuman about this man who lost someone who's very close and near and dear to him to go out there and perform that well. And that's why. And to me, I'm not here to shame anyone who's really going through something, but I can't help but, you know, applaud or value. Same thing with Isaiah Thomas when his sister died in the middle of the playoffs and he went out there and played. Like, that is something to be applauded, that someone has that sort of mental strength to go through that and still perform. The other part of it is, the other side of that coin is, and maybe I'm one of those people who takes an exception and makes it a slippery slope, but I don't want for athletes or anybody to basically be able to always fall back on mental health when they don't perform. There's a difference between I couldn't perform because I was under immense, unusual, undue stress, like a parent dying or something like that, versus I'm feeling down in the dumps because I haven't been playing well. Ipso facto, mental health, don't be mad at me, y'all. That's the part that I worry about. And by the way, I don't even worry about it in terms of people taking that decision. Hey, I don't feel comfortable competing because I'm going through some stuff. I worry about it in the sense of the parade we hold for these people every time they do so.
Well, that's also a social media piece of it too, because the
absolutely.
Let's not forget that the Twitter storm is very different than the conversations taking place in real life, right? I mean, when we were talking about Naomi Osaka, for example, my feed was essentially a force field protecting Naomi Osaka and attacking us, enemy of the people, for even asking about this and even having a conversation about it. But then when you step away and you actually turn the damn machine off, you know, you turn the phone off or go talk to people, they're actually having a conversation more like this one, which is, well, isn't this part of the champion's journey? Isn't this what part of it all means? And I think that what we're really talking about here in a lot of ways is control. And you're talking, I mean, about tragedy. I think also what Kate's talking about and what Tom's talking about as well isn't even just the tragedy when something catastrophic happens in our lives. It's, I'm just not doing well. And not an excuse to say I'm not playing well, therefore I'm going to use this as a shield. But to play this game, to play these games, takes an enormous toll. But the other part of it that really deserves a lot of explication too is what is how this industry and how this culture handles that piece of it, which is, can you go on the DL because you're in a bad space? What do we do to that athlete? What happens when that athlete admits it? I see this in the lineage of player empowerment. If you start looking at where the athletes have come in the past decade in terms of controlling their industry, controlling how they feel, they're essentially saying, look, we're rewriting the rules here, right? We are rewriting what is considered acceptable. And if I don't want to answer questions because I feel like this is bad for me, as Osaka did, okay, this is something to be considered. And I need you as a public and as a media to accept that there are going to be things that you once found unacceptable, and as an industry, that the league that you once found unacceptable, and now you're going to have to accept them, which is me admitting that this game is killing me, right? That you have to now factor that in with some compassion. Is this industry willing to do that?
Yeah, this idea of control is crucial, because the pushback on what is acceptable and is there a world in which athletes should be allowed to take days off and say publicly, in some form or another, this is a mental health day. And in addition, the control to say these structures that are around the sport, whether it's press conferences, media availability in the NBA, in tennis, all of the press conferences that they do, the control to say when they're doing them, how they're structured, how they want to respond in and have more flexibility given where they're at, all of that being about control. Like a quick story that I thought of when I was writing the essay that we first listened to was how when I was playing college basketball, I was not in a good mental health space. Like my first year, I didn't have mental illness, right? I wouldn't have labeled myself depressive. I wasn't taking prescription drugs, but I was just didn't feel good, quote unquote. And one day before practice, because I knew I couldn't say I don't feel good mentally, I consumed an entire bottle of iron pills that were sitting in my dorm room because I was like, I need a physical symptom to present itself to get out of this practice. Yeah. Yeah. I need to be vomiting when I go down there. So, and I think about that in relation to this conversation because I think a lot of athletes have felt at various points that they needed a physical ailment or they were spinning because they couldn't say in past years, like Simone Biles did, like, I'm not participating because I'm not ready to participate. But they made something up or they did something.
You have to make something up because we accept the physical. Okay, yep. Your ankle's busted. Okay, you can't play, right? But if your head's not right, you're weak. Right. If you're not in the right place to play, you're weak. And I think that there's a difference. I think when I saw the Osaka story at first, the piece of this was when you're talking about control. The first thing that came to my mind was that tug of war between the accountability that the professional athlete has that the movie stars don't have, that the singers don't have, that, you know, because the athletes are like, no, we do this live every day. And part of our culture, part of the historical culture of professional sports in the 20th century is when your performance is over, you give an account of your performance, right? That's the piece of this that is really being rewritten. And it's like, okay, maybe that piece isn't going to be part of that anymore. How much do you owe the sport? How much of that cultural piece still needs to exist? The other piece of that is how much of me do I have to give to you as a performer? And I think that I think that's really the big piece of this battle. I think Kate makes a really great point, making the distinction between mental illness and mental health. And I think that, I mean, you start looking at players and you look and, I don't know, take Nick Anderson, you know, you miss a couple of free throws, you know, to Amin's point, there's a difference between the day job and the mistakes that come with the day job and the successes that come with the day job than something beyond that. Like if you're watching the Malice in the Palace doc or the Ron Artest doc before, and he's talking about, I was not physically well. Huge gap between those two.
Right. And I wonder I don't want to call it a slippery slope, but on the spectrum of mental health illness and depression, where does like the clutch gene or collapsing under pressure fall on that spectrum? Because isn't that so much of how we talk about sports is when Ben Simmons shies away from a layup in the clutch moments of the game and everyone dunks on him and makes fun of him and he becomes meme after meme. And I'm part of this. I'm part of tweeting about, oh my God, did you see Ben Simmons completely disappear in the fourth quarters of games 3 through 7? And I think part of me feels a little icky about that is like, am I contributing to any sort of mental yips or mental, I don't want to say frailty, but something is not wired correctly for Ben Simmons compared to what it was, I'm guessing,
isn't that what
a
the
few
money's
years
for?
Ago.
Thank you.
I mean, that's what the money's for. I mean, like when we, and this is
Don Draper.
This is how they measure themselves, right? Like, I'm just going to come out and say it. I'm not going to say this is true or not because I haven't spoken to anybody about it. But when Osaka was going through her thing and you had Venus come out there at Wimbledon, I think it was, and she said to the media, well, I'm just going to say I'm better than every one of you guys out here. None of y'all can do what I can do, right? That wasn't a shot at us. That sounded like a shot at her.
Mm-hmm.
And when Serena was like, some people are thin, I'm thick. What they're really saying is, I'm built for this. Maybe you're not built for this. This is how the athletes measure themselves as well. This is part of the game.
In the same way, Howard, that you were pointing out that the conversations happening on Twitter about Osaka or Simone Biles weren't reflective of the offline conversations that you might have when you're out to drinks with people. Similarly, I do feel that the feedback that the athletes get, like Osaka, the brands she's aligned with publicly facing, use that as an opportunity to make public statements about how they, you know, support through thick and thin.
And that really, really bothered me, Kate. I got to tell you, like when Calm came in and I was like, oh, so now we're exploiting too. Now, now this is a marketing opportunity as well. And I was thinking, well, wait a minute. If you want to take the umbrella of mental health, you can't just say the mental health pieces of it are the parts that hurt me. They're also the parts that you benefit from too, right? The enormous pressure of having to do all of these ads and to having all your time taken up. You can't just say that the bad part of it is the bad part of it. It's all toxic. Even the parts that make you that $30, $40 million, those parts are toxic as well. But those are good toxicities because they're lining up your pocket. Talking to media doesn't necessarily help you. or at least you don't think it does, which is why I thought it was also fascinating to me that if you notice the athletes in tennis during the summer, they wished Naomi Osaka well, but very few of them said, yeah, this needs to change.
Because that's the job.
Because it's part of the job.
That's the job. It's the part that I don't get. And for me, for Osaka, the part I really struggled with, going back to what you said, Howard, about toxicity, but it's we're picking and choosing the toxicity we like or we don't like. Her feeling a way about the questions. And then I want to say, like, the next week or 2 weeks later, the video that she puts out with her boyfriend, who's a music artist, and all of these deeply, like, revealing things that there's no purpose to that other than feeding that toxicity. But in this case, it's the toxicity that makes me feel good. Right? Ooh, our favorite place to do it or whatever. You know, all those silly little things you do in those videos. They're harmless, but they are fruit of the same tree that you're running from when it comes to doing your job. And by the way, the people asking those questions, they're not asking questions about questions that truly cross a line. That's highly unprofessional or irrelevant to what's happening here. I played a game. You got questions about the game. Ask it. Don't ask me about my divorce. Don't ask me about my gambling addiction, whatever. Ask me about my performance in this game. They're asking her about her performance in the game. That's part of the job. And this thing where you get to choose a la carte what parts of this I will embrace and what parts I will demand change in, to me is just kind of, it's insanity. I always go back to, look, if you don't want to do all that stuff, go be Kawhi Leonard. Go be Kawhi Leonard. That's an option.
Go be Tim Duncan.
Go be Tim Duncan. Go be Marshawn Lynch. That's an option for you as well. But you want to open up and show people who you really are and this is my real true life and all this stuff.
That's the addicting part of it, right? Because that piece of it is also, to Kate's point at the beginning, that's also part of the social media, that validation you get too when you look up and you got 22,000 likes to something asinine that you said, the most basic thing. What should I have for dinner? 30,000 likes, right? I mean, this is the thing. This is that two-way stuff. But I think the other piece of it, what really hurt Osaka in a lot of ways, was this was real. She came out and when she said, I have been struggling since winning the US Open in 2018, right? I thought that was a remarkable admission. And I thought that there was going to be a lot of depth following that. And what followed that was a documentary immediately following, right? Came a three-part documentary, which did not mention in that documentary any struggles.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't mention anything about where we were in the now. Now, obviously, she had said, well, that doc was finished before this happened. Okay, that's fine, whatever. But the juxtaposition of here are the things that I don't like and they are harming me against this enormous endorsement machine that was an avalanche this summer. Sweet Greens and Levi's and this whatever bag coach or whoever and all of this stuff. And it was like, can you have it both ways? And I started to conclude with all of that attention. And then, you know, she's at the Met Gala and the whole thing. And I'm thinking, I'm not saying you're not struggling. I'm saying this as a look is a really interesting, difficult optic for people trying to understand. Because it struck me that you're not really struggling with the life. You don't want to answer questions.
Hey everybody, it's Mike, and typically I record these Miller Lite spots in the studio, but I requested that I specifically record this one from my home office because I got a window, and I'm looking outside at those beautiful fishtail palms, knowing that in just a few seconds, I'm going to go out there, I'm going to crack open a can of Miller Lite, because while sitting outside by my fishtail palms is usually a good time, I like to take it up a notch and make it a Miller time. That's right, you crack that puppy open, and you don't have to think about what you're drinking for a darn second. A lot has changed over the years, including my backyard. Lots of landscaping being done right now. But the one thing that hasn't changed is the undebatable quality of Miller Lite. You don't have to choose what quality is the best. Miller Lite has great taste, and it's less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/Dan, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces, fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.
Kate, I want to go back to what you said about, is it going to be okay to have a mental health day or take practice off because you're just not in the right headspace? It reminds me of the fact that, like, you tried to take some pills to have a physical symptom, right? And the fact that we are so far behind the science of what happens upstairs compared to what happens with a broken ankle. Like, 100 years ago, if you're coming in and saying, hey, man, my leg hurts, everyone on the team's like, yeah, my leg hurts too, all right? And you're like, no, it really hurts. Like, this is different. Would they be able to take an x-ray and look at your broken ankle and differentiate between your buddy who turned his ankle and it might be a little black and blue, but he can play on it, right? That's what we're talking about here is, I think in the end of the NBA playoffs, the cliche is everybody's not 100%. And I think if certain players take a week off to deal with their mental health issues, Kyrie Irving comes to mind here, where he didn't speak to the media for a while. Kevin Durant a couple years ago didn't speak to the media. Falls under the same umbrella where I'm guessing teammates were looking at this and saying, Kyrie, I'm dealing with the same pressures that you are. I got to talk to this reporter and go on this Zoom call and answer questions about you now.
That's right. Well, that's what I mean about the rewriting though, right, Tom? And I'm glad you brought up Kyrie and Durant, because those two guys are central to sort of the rewriting of this. They are now creating a totally new landscape. And you can, you know, we're going to find out how much of it is simple control. I don't want to talk to you anymore. I think that there's also a privatization that's taking place right now too, where these players are so powerful, they are wiping out public journalism. They don't have to talk to the public. They are beyond the public. They're going to talk on the boardroom or the shop or some other protected space where they're able to say things the way they want to say them and not be questioned. I believe that what these athletes are really doing, they are using the enormous power that they have. That is no different than presidents, no different than any other public person out there. They do not want to be accountable. And if they have the power not to be, they want the questions and the answers on their terms.
I'll give a layup to Amin here, but then give up the money. Like, if you don't want to participate in the media dealings, if you do not want to participate with TNT's halftime or postgame or in between the sideline reports, then give up the money.
Yeah. Well, that's why this is a question about power, right? This is why, in addition to the mental health questions of what these games are doing to us and what they're doing to them as athletes, there's also the other side of this, which is control. Who gets to control this thing? And one of the reasons why I think people have been so sympathetic to the athletes is because the athletes have been in such a disadvantageous position on this question for decades. They had to talk. They had to deal with stupid questions. And especially when you're talking about it from a race and gender standpoint, the questions that these two ridiculously remarkable Black women had to deal with, Serena and Venus, I mean, the hostility that they went through, people are now looking at this and they're placing that dispensation onto the Osakas and the Coco Gauffs and everybody else coming forward saying, you don't have to go through this, whether or not the individual issue is the same. When Naomi Osaka, after she lost to Leyla Fernandez, and she said, I need to take some time off of this game, that struck me as not a media question. That struck me as she's struggling with performance. And I thought that was actually kind of poignant.
Look, I saw this a lot working in the front office, right? You have players who genuinely love the game, wanted to be as best as they could on the floor. Some of them are stars, some of them are role players, but their goal was to maximize their talents and abilities on the court. And that doesn't mean they didn't have outside interests, but that was the approach they took to their job every day. And then there were players who enjoyed the profession for the perks that it provided. The lifestyle, the money, the attention, the ability to get a table at any restaurant or get into any club in America, right? The ability to walk in somewhere and have Denzel Washington and the president and all these people know who you are and want to come up and talk to you, right? And by the way, some of those players were really good players, but they were addicted to the life. And so there's a point in every one of those guys' careers where the game is less and less and the life is more and more. And it reminds me of like the old parable. It said if you take a wooden boat and you replace one plank, is it still the same boat? Now, if you keep replacing planks, at some point, you replace every single plank on the wooden boat. Is it a brand new boat?
Ship of Theseus, I mean.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you. thank you for making me sound smarter. The ship of Theseus, right? So there's a little bit of that going on, I think, where they like being somewhere, but they don't like the means to get there. And at some point, it just becomes So, for instance, Naomi Osaka losing a U.S. Open, you know, needs him to take some time off. Let me go hit up the Met Gala. Like, that's not someone I don't want to question another person's mental state. Like Tom said, you can't X-ray that. But the behavior is inconsistent with someone who's dealing with the pressures of too much. The behavior would indicate, I think, someone who's dealing with that would retract from public eye. I remember, like, Shamiqua Holtzclaw is a name that maybe if she played today, her story would be sung and praised and have parades about.
I want to jump in here just because I think we should set again this like distinction between mental health and mental illness. Because when you bring up Shamiqua Holtzclaw, you're talking legitimately mental illness,
right?
And she did completely pull herself out of the day to day churn, and and she will speak openly about, you know, the prescription drugs she's been on and the personality disorder that she is dealing with. And so, again, to like table set here, the difference between like mental health not being the absence of mental illness. So on one hand, there's mental illness. And on the other, mental health is a thing that we're all should be, if we're proactive about engaging in. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're practicing. You're not just waiting for a breakdown that can happen to many of us.
That's right. I mean, I usually go on a Twitter hiatus probably a couple times a year, usually for about 3 months or so, just because two things are happening. One, it's too much input, right? I mean, everybody's got something to say about everything. And it's like, and my brain is taking me away from what I have to do, which is I'm not getting paid to be on Twitter, right? This is not my job.
Right.
And you're recognizing at my very, very, very small 63,000 follower level, right? Never mind someone who's got 200 million followers or, you know, however many followers, the most, you know, some people have, you know, I think Bomani's got like 300 million, you know, however many followers Bo's got,
right?
Some ridiculous number. I don't know how many Beyonce followers, 300,000. I didn't say 300 million. I can't believe I said 300 million. So anyway,
he's so, a popular guy.
And so when you start looking at that and you become addicted to that response and you need that response and you need that two-way, it does things to you. And I think that to Amin's point, good and the bad.
I wanted to push back a little bit. Not a little bit. I actually was just going to push back on Amin because I think the road you were walking down was suggesting that athletes who are lifestyle athletes will use the cover of this mental health topic, hot button topic, as a means to free themselves from obligations that they don't want to be a part of. And I feel like that's a little bit of a red herring that would be happening, that guys would take advantage of that, because I still think there's the issue of the internal response within teams and among athletes to all of this, that we're sort of, you touched on, Howard, with Serena perhaps looking at other players and being like, you're not built for this. That there could be one response publicly to any athlete that we've named being talking about a mental health issue, but they still know that there is a reality that they're living with among their team, that those teammates know what that was about, whether it was about something real and that they know that that person deals with depression or deals with a mental illness side of this, or whether that person is one of the lifestyle people who is opportunistic. And there's still that equation that they're having to deal with.
Well, that's why so much of this is cultural. What we're really talking about in a lot of ways is twofold. One, you're talking about how the individual deals with the universe that in which they live. And then you're talking about the universe itself. Right? The universe itself being this sports industry that we are all a part of. And we know the idea of toughness, so many different examples. But I remember when I was covering the Washington football team, I think they were playing Seattle in the playoffs in 06. And I remember talking to Cornelius Griffin, who is the, you know, defensive tackle for Washington. And we were talking a couple of days before the game, and that was the year Sean Alexander was going to win the MVP. He was just running through everybody with the Seahawks. And they were like, nah, man, just hit him. We're going to hit him hard in the first quarter. We're going to break him. And here we go. This is part of this. This is part of the all of the different puzzle pieces. And this person's not mentally tough, and that's why they double fault serving for the match, right? There is a currency to this. This is part of the compensation. There are reasons why some guys don't get paid because the organization or the league knows when it comes crunch time, you're not going to be there. You're not going to be good enough. And so all of these different pieces have to be factored in because the industry factors them in, right?
So, Howard, I want to ask a question to the panel. But before I do that, I just want to address something you just said about that concept, which is something that's existed in sports since the beginning of time, which is there are people who have reputations. So a great example, there's a guy I know played in the league in the 70s. He's telling about the story about the first time he had to guard Kareem. And so he asked the vets, so what do I do? You want me to like kind of like be physical, shove him off the block? Said, no, don't do that. Said, if we're lucky, he won't notice you and he'll only drop 30 and 20. You start trying to hit him and fight him and stuff, then he's going to get mad. And now we've got like a 50-pointer on our hands. And that was like legitimately the scouting report on Kareem. It's just like, be there, but don't push it, because if you do, you will engage the monster. Exactly, the monster that wants to just take a nice nap through this game and win. Compare and contrast, there's another Hall of Famer whose name I won't say, and also obviously a big, they said, hit him, he'll quit. That's on the scouting report, like, be physical with him, hit him, by the second quarter, he'll quit. That's a real thing, man. Now, whatever the psychology you want to use to explain what's happening there, and maybe there was this, maybe there was, it doesn't matter. Because at the end of the day, there's two goals in sports. One is to win, and two is to make money. And everything else that you guys...
I'm sorry, it's the other way around.
Not necessarily in that order, right? So everything else sounds nice and inspirational and all that, but from a business standpoint, for both the individuals and the organizations, those are the guiding principles, and everything else is just an excuse for why you didn't get that done.
And don't forget that all of those things have been used. They are used to sign players. They are used to cut players. They are used to compensate players. They're used to keep people out of the game. Remember, that used to be the reputation of black players as a reason for not integrating, that they weren't tough enough. Hit a black player, you know, hit him in the knees or whatever in football, and then they're going to quit, right? They're not as tough. And so one of the really interesting pieces of all of this is, once again, this narrative of control that I think that that we have to pay attention to the fact that what the athletes are doing in some ways, to Amin's disgust, is they are creating a new paradigm, whether it's legit or not, to say, we're going to control who gets to ask us questions, right? And we're going to control how we deal with these questions. And, you know, I remember talking to Billie Jean King about this a couple of weeks ago, and she sounded just like you. She's like, that's part of the job. And I'm listening to this and I'm going, for how much longer?
Amin, you said there are two goals in sports. Well, now I'll reverse it for you. Make money and win. I think one of the things we're dancing around is the fact that making money right now, if you're in the mental health conversation, it's happening.
Yes.
You know?
It's lucrative.
But it's not necessarily, although you could argue that being able to speak openly about it, even if you're taking days off, in totality might lead to a better athlete. More rest, being allowed to be real about the way you're feeling. You could argue, and I would argue that in many ways this is a good thing, because you may have people taking days off that they didn't take off, or they used to take off, but they used to tell you it was one thing and now they're being honest about it. But in totality, you are going to get, over the course of a career, better performances.
I don't think we should ignore the fact that these are competitive people, that they're wired to beat and dominate and triumph over adversity.
Taught to do that since age 5, taught to dominate.
So the idea of, I'm going to sit this practice out because I'm having a tough day, or I'm going to use mental health as an excuse to like get my get everything in order, I think that might be overblown. The idea that athletes are going to use mental health as an excuse to just take a break, because I don't know, I think they would panic about their status. They would panic about who else is getting more likes than them, or who else is
costing them money too.
Right. And I think, yes, there is a concern here that maybe they'll use this magic wand of mental health to take a break from the obligations. But I also think there's this other side of it, which is, man, I just watched my starting position go up in flames because I was out for a week and then this player subbed in and the team went on a win streak.
There's also a weird gray area where both things can be true, where the player can truly believe this is the reason why, when in actuality something else is happening. And especially as the conversation is more public and is being held in this arena of people who are competing in performative Olympics, showing how much I care about this. No matter what, no, you got to protect whatever. You know, I said, oh, you can't lose your starting job due to injury, right? When the starter gets healthy, he comes back, he gets his job back. Is the same thing true for mental health? I don't know. I think about, and again, this Kate's going to jump on me and tell me this is that's mental illness versus mental health. But again, one of the earliest examples of this, I think of Royce White,
mm-hmm.
who was very public about his anxiety and all this stuff. And I remember, and this was my first days of being a media guy, because I scouted Royce White as a prospect. That was one of the last things I did, was turn in my Royce White scouting reports and intel reports and everything. So I remember starting this media career and being on Twitter, and all these people say, yeah, Royce White, yeah, you guys should draft him. And if you don't draft him, you're discriminating. And I said, that's the job, though. That's the, I mean, I feel for him for having
What's
to go
the job?
Through these.
What do you mean? What is the job, you mean?
All of these things that you got to do.
Getting on an airplane.
Getting on an airplane. I just wanted, for people who didn't know the story of Royce White. Specifically, he had anxiety about flying. And so that's part of the ecosystem of being an NBA player, is what you're saying. Yeah.
Just to give an analogy, I am for equality of opportunities for everybody, right? But within reason, sometimes there are things that, like, I can't hire a blind person to do my video editing. That's not me discriminating against the blind. That is an impairment that gets in the way of this person's ability to do that job.
I think that what's really taking place here, and where the tension is, all of this is a great conversation. I think it really is about power. I think a lot of it is really about power. I think it's about the power of the athlete to be able to redraw the rules that the organization and the fans and media accept things that they maybe never accepted in the past. Take a look at the Mets, for example, right? So the Mets are struggling, and then the Mets are booing their own fans, right? The Mets are tired of being booed. So now they went through a little stretch where they started booing the fans back, right? What was that? That was the player way of saying, we've been, you don't get to just do this to us anymore, right? They're redrawing the rules. The rules across sports right now are being rewritten, right? They're being rewritten because the players have more power than they've ever had before. Now, did it look weird and silly and ridiculous and you started laughing at it? Kind of, yeah. But at the same time, I thought there was a real message there. And it's not that different a message than Naomi Osaka's message, which is to say, I'm taking as much control of this, I'm taking more control of this than I ever have before.
Do you think that there's something in the fact that that's an individual sport?
Tennis to do with it.
Versus gymnastics, where yes, it is a team sport, but also it's an individual sport.
Yeah. Like, John McEnroe more so. Said something really great, Tom. John McEnroe once said that pressure is the possibility you could lose, right? That's pressure. And so when we're parsing through all of these different things, I don't view pressure necessarily as a mental health issue as much as I view it as how you're reacting to this and what it's doing to you, right? What is it doing to you over the long haul? And you start reaching a point where you just can't, right? And that's what this, to me, the battle is all about. It's who gets to control that landscape.
Man. I know.
You want more? You want more?
We got to round two. We'll just do this round. Go. No, do a round two, Kate, next week, 2 weeks from now.
I'll tease what the round two is. And I'm going to just tease it very generically. If you walk around beating a drum about how great you are, yes, the real estate you have for saying I'm not having a good day due to mental health becomes a lot smaller. And I'll let that be the tease for next time.
All right. Meadowlark Brain Trust.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, that's right. Amin, really. Leaving people with just like a big red heart there. Thank you.
And now I'm trying to figure out who he's talking about here. So maybe that's my homework assignment, or everyone's homework assignment.
Talk about Dan. He's not here.
Yeah. I just want to know who the big man is that you just had to knock him out and he was done in the second quarter. Not even half.
That's right. Amin, Howard, Tom, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kate.
Hey, everybody, it's Mike, and typically I record these Miller Lite spots in the studio, but I requested that I specifically record this one from my home office because I got a window, and I'm looking outside at those beautiful fishtail palms, knowing that in just a few seconds, I'm going to go out there, I'm going to crack open a can of Miller Lite, because while sitting outside by my fishtail palms is usually a good time, I like to take it up a notch and make it a Miller time. That's right, you crack that puppy open, and you don't have to think. about what you're drinking for a darn second. A lot has changed over the years, including my backyard. Lots of landscaping being done right now. But the one thing that hasn't changed is the undebatable quality of Miller Lite. You don't have to choose what quality is the best. Miller Lite has great taste, and it's less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/Dan, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces, fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.